Hi, welcome to this meeting. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and I just want to express a very large welcome to all of you. And you're really lucky. We normally have it a little hotter here than it is. The rain is a blessing, believe me. And I got to tell you, last night when all those people were coming back from the Alamo Dome, wandering back, it kind of reminded me of that movie War of the Worlds, when the people were kind of wandering aimlessly and those machines were just shooting them like that. Kind of the deal there. Let's ask for a moment of silent meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, I'm going to go ahead, and our topic for this meeting today is meeting anonymity. Autonomy. And anonymity, right? Autonomy. And I thought about that title for just a minute the other day when they were telling me about this meeting, and Rick Walker had asked me to chair it. And he looked a little frazzled. He's the guy running the whole convention for the General Service Office. And yesterday afternoon, he looked a little bit frazzled. This is the largest convention ever held in the city of San Antonio. So you're part of some real history around here. But I was thinking about my experience in AA with meetings. I wound up in a nut house out here in the north end of town in 1987, bottomed out totally from alcoholism, and the first thing the nut house did was send me to AA meetings and made me get a sponsor. And over the period of about 2 months, I became what we usually become early on in recovery, a zealot. And part of my zealotism was that we had a meeting at this nut house, and even after I got out of the nut house, I would go back on Saturday and run the meeting. And so it was a meeting held in a center for recovery, and so they provided the coffee and all the stuff, and it was really cool. They had a nice venue, pretty clean, and a lot different than a lot of AA meetings. And what I would do is I would go in and everything, I'd get it all set up, and I'd go in and I'd drag the patients down from the ward and throw them into their chairs and smash a book in their lap, and that, by God, was going to be recovery for these people. And one day, after I'd done this about a month, I was telling my sponsor what a great guy I was and how far I'd come along in my program and how well I was doing running this meeting, and he looked at me and he said, "You can never go to that meeting again." And so that's what I know about this subject. And we have three great speakers today who know a lot more than I do. We have Kathy from Maryland, and we have Dave from Michigan on the end, and of course we have Diane from Missouri. So I think we'll start out with Kathy, and we'll turn the meeting over to you.
I'm Kathy S., and I'm an alcoholic. It's probably the most important thing that I'll say. I was kind of unsure exactly how this format was supposed to be. In my experience with service work, this was more of a panel discussion. And so that's why I have my typewritten thing, because my service sponsor told me that's how I'm supposed to do it. Listen to people every now and then. And I'm getting old, so I have to wear readers. I am the district committee member for District 21, Area 29, in the state of Maryland. And I'm very blessed to have been given the opportunity to come and share with you about this topic. A past sponsor taught me an important lesson that you have to live your truth. That still sticks with me. As I said, every now and then I do listen to people. I at times have the inflated notion that I am clever and philosophical, have some great theoretical insights that would wow anybody, but it's amazing how many people don't listen. God reminded me on Tuesday that he's the original thinker, not me. And I was very ready for some insight from him on Tuesday because I had not yet started this presentation. To God's credit, he never leaves me stranded, and it was amazing the things that he pulled in, because I actually was searching in articles and pieces of literature and those kinds of things for stuff about this topic. Procrastination, I have found, pushes those adrenaline valves open full throttle, and I think that I'm just got everything under control. That's the kind of keen alcoholic thinking that I'm glad I have a program for. And I'm still a toddler in this program. In Maryland, we share our sobriety dates. And my sobriety date was January 6th of 2007. So I'm only three. Thank you. My home group is the Beginners Group in Salisbury, Maryland. We meet on Fridays at 7 o'clock. And generally, that meeting is, by its name, we draw from the local shelter programs. So we get about half of the room are people from vans, and the other half of the room are local people, and we kind of mingle together. And that's the kind of home group background that I have. We're very laid back and loose in our structure because of the nature of our home group. I mean, it's kind of hard to be a Nazi when you have half a room full of van people. We're just laid back, and I love my home group. The concepts of unity and autonomy exist together in our tradition, as if it makes sense for them to. And I thought about it, and in some ways they're kind of contradictory. That was my first thought and spark about this topic, and it intrigued me that the two were so oppositional. How can we espouse unity, common welfare, when we also support group autonomy and self-directing freedom? I started reading various things, and I realized that I am not unique, and someone before me had had these thoughts. Jeanette W. of Southwest Quebec gave a presentation at the 2009 59th General Service Conference on Living the Tradition. On page 21 of the final conference report, it states, "Unity, I believe, is the opposite of uniformity. We can really talk of unity when we welcome and embrace diversity. We should not fear diversity. Our traditions are perfectly adapted to preserve AA's future and the universal stature of nature of our fellowship. It is no wonder Bill W. originally called them 12 points to ensure our future. The 12 traditions are our best protection against anything that could harm us from the inside or from the outside. Like water, they are strong enough to drill through a hole in a rock as hard as my head and supple enough to fit in any space." And thank you, Jeanette, wherever you are, for putting those words to my thoughts, because I read that the very first literature I picked up, and that was like, wow, that's exactly what was rolling in my brain with this topic. I can't seem to separate the first and fourth traditions because they seem to kind of balance off each other. They're tandem concepts. In the long form of the tradition, four, Bill wrote, "With respect to its own affairs, each AA group should be responsible to no other authority than its own group conscience. But when its plans concern welfare of neighboring groups also, those groups ought to be consulted. And no group, regional committee, or individual should ever take any action that might greatly affect AA as a whole without conferring with the trustees of the General Service Board. On such, our common welfare is paramount." Autonomy is not a fought-for idea when general uniformity exists. It kind of just sits there. You don't really think about autonomy when everyone is the same anyway, and I think most of us in our little geographical regions probably find that we tend to get all AA the same. The AA in my area is like that. They hold high the traditions, but honestly, most of the there's 26 groups in my district, and were fairly similar. There's really not a whole lot of differences among the way that our groups are run and the way that they handle situations. So group autonomy doesn't really come up. Food and fellowship are good gardens, though, for differences to take root. How many of you celebrate anniversaries? Actually do something? Okay. All but one of our groups do, they actually celebrate. They have an event when someone has an anniversary. And the other one simply acknowledges anniversaries, just like anyone coming up and get a six-month chip. Harold comes up and gets his 30-year chip, and Harold goes and sits back down. That's only one meeting. The rest of us have all kinds of food and stuff that we like to do. Some have cake. Some have brownies. One guy always brings a bowl of fruit along with the baked goods for his meeting. I like that meeting. A couple of groups have hot dog meetings, and that's what we call them. They're having a hot dog meeting. They have hot dogs and chips and stuff for their anniversary. One group has a really large spread. I mean, meatballs and chicken wings and potato salad. That's what we call, in Maryland, we call it the eatin' meetin'. And at my home group, we have a very gracious member of our home group that makes cupcakes for us. And she asks us what kind of cupcakes we like. And she will do that for us. We started out with the brownie tradition, and we had a brownie pan. And you're looking at the person that screwed that up because I procrastinate, as I said earlier. So after my first year anniversary, I had the pan because the last person had the pan and made the brownies and brought it to the meeting. And then I'm supposed to take the pan home with me after my anniversary, and then I save it. And then whenever the next one is, I make brownies. I bring the pan back. I give it to that person. That's how it was done. Well, I procrastinate, and I didn't make the brownies. So I went to Sam's Club and bought brownies, okay, which meant I didn't bring the pan to the meeting with me. And then the pan just disappeared. In all honesty, I had to confess, like, 3 months later, everyone was like, well, what happened to the brownie pan? I was like, I have it at home. So we went to cupcakes after that. Because it was, we're a very loose group, so obviously I'm not the only one that had a problem keeping up with stuff. So now Debbie makes cupcakes for us, and she's the only one, and we don't have to worry about rotating, and we don't have to depend on the craziness of others. Usually it's a speakers meeting at our anniversaries. It's my anniversary, and I pick Sally S. to come and speak for me. Some of our meetings are large enough that if they had did a single anniversary every time there was an anniversary, they would have nothing but anniversary meetings all year long. So some of them have chosen to go to the last group of the month, whoever had that month. They all have a collaborative meeting, and it's a perfect example of how a spiritual program works, because you have four people up there with probably 100 years of sobriety, and they all have to pick one speaker, and they do it very well. There is that, to me, that one day of year a year that it actually is all about me for once. For an hour, it is about me. Any other time in the program, it's not about me. So I like the celebration meetings. That's a cool thing. And I get to eat cake. What does any of that have to do with sobriety? Not really a whole lot. And it's amazing how much people's feathers get ruffled when you're talking about food for some reason. This is just a personal group choice on fellowship and friendship, and it gives newcomers hope when they come in and see that person and they have this birthday party. Some of us have never had such good belly button birthday parties as we do our AA birthdays. And when you have a newcomer sitting there and they see that, that's hopeful. So it is important to sobriety, but it's really not something that, it's not a part of our tradition. That's on your group. You're autonomous. You pick how you want to do that. Some people don't like you to eat in the meeting, and this is where the feathers get ruffled in my area. When I was new, I sat there and I'm like, really? People are getting upset because somebody went up and cut the cake before the meeting. oh my God, you know, the hurricane is coming through. And it's different, and it's weird how it's not written down anywhere, but somehow everybody's supposed to know how each group does something, but it certainly isn't on the wall with the 12 steps. But there's some places, some old-timers do not eat during the meeting. It's sacrilegious, apparently. Other groups cut the cake there beforehand. If you don't want to eat it, don't eat it, but don't complain afterwards if there's none left. And people eat beforehand. The hot dog meeting, you eat beforehand. And then most of the other meetings, it's after. It all sits there on the table and everybody salivates during the meeting and waits. And after you go smoke, then you come back in and get your cake and you're good. In my opinion, I remember one thing my mother taught me, and that is when you're in someone else's house, be polite and respect their traditions, even if it's new or doesn't make sense to you. And as an adult, if I visit someone's home and they do something in a very strange way or something that might offend my sensibilities, I can choose not to go back. And that's simply, you know, habits of that household. Well, home groups are homes, too. I've learned to remain open to those little differences. It makes life much more interesting. Bill knew that AA would be more varied across the world than anybody could imagine. And to try to enforce some set of rules would be complete insanity. May I be blessed enough to travel to as many home groups that are in this room someday? I would love it. I haven't. I have my little teeny world of AA so far. Obviously, cake and hot dogs, that's fluffy stuff. It's not a hard-hitting example of tradition for autonomy. In November of 1969, the same month that I was born, a series of articles on the 12 traditions of AA began running in the AA grapevine. And in those articles, a list of questions primarily intended for individuals was published. One, do I insist that there are only a few right ways of doing things in AA? Two, does my group always consider the welfare of AA first? Do I put down other members' behavior when it's different from mine, or do I learn from it? Do I always bear in mind that to those outsiders who know I am an AA, I may to some extent represent our entire beloved fellowship? Am I willing to help a newcomer go to any lengths, his lengths, not mine, to stay sober? And do I share my knowledge of AA tools with other members who may not have heard of them? This tradition's checklist of sorts helps an individual in a home group ensure that AA will be there for those not born yet. They were published then for me to use today, and for every baby born today to use from years from now. My home group gets together annually to fellowship and take a group inventory. And the pamphlet, the AA group, it states each group is as unique as a thumbprint, and approaches to carrying the message of sobriety vary not just from group to group, but from region to region. Acting autonomously, each group charts its own course. The better informed the members, the stronger and more cohesive the group, and the greater assurance that when a newcomer reaches out for help, the hand of AA will always be there. Most of us cannot recover unless there is a group. As Bill said, realization dawns on each member that he is but a small part of a great whole. He learns that the clamor of desires and ambitions within him must be silenced whenever these could damage the group. It becomes plain that the group must survive or the individual will not. Alcoholics rarely take well to absolutes that others give them. We kind of bristle a little bit at that. We get ruffled even at suggestions, even when they're politely put to us, that suggestions. But the real test of a program of spiritual principles is ensuring that the right of others to make their own mistakes while not allowing them to trample on me in the process. There was a closing talk at the 1986 General Service Conference And the general manager at the time, Bob Pearson, said something, and this is back in 1986. It kind of blew me away. If you were to ask me what is the greatest danger facing AA today, I would have to answer the growing rigidity that is so apparent to me and others, the increasing demand for absolute answers to nitpicking questions, pressure for GSO to enforce our tradition. And in this trend towards rigidity, we are drifting farther and farther away from our co-founders. Bill, in particular, must be spinning in his grave, for I remind you that he was perhaps the most permissive person I have ever met. One of his favorite sayings was, "Every group has the right to be wrong." He was maddeningly tolerant of his critics. He had absolute faith that faults in AA were self-correcting. What Mr. Pearson shared is true today. Groups have the right of autonomy, but they must keep the unity of this fellowship at the center of their choices. In closing, I found a letter that Bill wrote to a World Service meeting in October of 69. October 9th, 1969. Dear delegates, we of the General Services extend to you our warmest greetings. We share with you our hope that this first meeting of its kind will later be seen as a turning point in AA's world affairs, perhaps a truly historic event. We shall try to get a clearer insight into the question of AA's leadership for the future, how it might be more effectively developed than at present. Country by country, we shall try to estimate the General Service needs of today and tomorrow. In short, we shall try to see more clearly what AA's world responsibilities really are and how these can better be met now and in the future. We wish to inaugurate an orderly and ever more effective evolution, not a damaging revolution. To me, these questions will always be crucial to the survival and unity of our world society, and every new generation of AAs will have to face them. Nothing can be taken for granted. Constant vigilance, keen foresight, immense dedication, plus an abiding faith. These will be the requirements if we are to fulfill AA's destiny. On matters of this import, I speak with great feeling, since more than one half of my AA life has been invested in the construction of AA, its principles, and its world services. Certainly, I am not the last word on AA. I am only one of the first ones. The future now belongs to you and to all those still to come. I am certain that you will merit God's grace. Ever devotedly, Bill W. And I read that and I realized that we really don't have any room for our petty, nitpicking little things. And your group has the right to do whatever your group wants to do, as long as it doesn't run across my back and AA's back everywhere else. And overall, unity is really the most important thing of our fellowship, or it won't be here for the people that are born today. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to serve.
Kathy, thank you very much. I have a question. Something came up on our home group the other day. In the room today, how many have you? How many groups that you all belong to have regularly scheduled group conscience meetings? And how many have meetings that just come up when you need them? Okay, that's really very interesting. So the majority, large majority, have regularly scheduled group conscience meetings. I'm now going to introduce our next speaker from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's our good friend Dave.
My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
My sobriety date is March 9th, 1975. That is the day I attended my first AA meeting at the Ishpeming Hematite Group. And I still go to that same group, the Ishpeming Hematite group. That's my home group. Anything I know about group autonomy, I probably pretty much learned from going to that group. The Upper Peninsula, I'm from Nagani, which is a little mining town. Iron mining is what we are. We're up by Lake Superior up in Michigan. We're known as Youpers. And right next to us is Ishpeming, another mining town, and they're right next to each other. Their city boundaries border each other. Nagani, roughly translated, it's an Indian word. It kind of means low area, and Ishpeming is higher, so it's a high area. But then over the years, it's like Nagani is hell and Ishpeming is heaven. So I drank in hell, and I sobered up in heaven, I guess, at the Ishpeming Hematite. On the way here, you know, I've been thinking about this topic. I knew what the topic was for a couple of months anyway, and I've been thinking about it. And it's not the type of topic that you just sit around at a meeting and say, well, tonight's meeting is going to be on autonomy. It don't happen. I mean, I do belong to another group in the Ghani, a Monday night group, and every month, they have a different format completely, but the second Monday of the month is a step corresponding to the month. That's the topic. And then the fourth Monday of the month is the tradition corresponding to the topic. However, in April of 2010, I was in Arizona, so I missed that particular meeting on that topic. we're going to talk about it. Don't get excited here now. I'm not going to. But anyway, on the way down here, I got to tell you some little stories, because I'm going to read you Daily Reflections for today, July 3rd. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. That's from Alcoholics Anonymous, page 87. And whoever picked this passage wrote, some say that experience is the best teacher. But I believe that experience is the only teacher. I have been able to learn of God's love for me only by the experience of my dependence on that love. At first, I could not be sure of his direction in my life, but now I see that if I am to be bold enough to ask for his guidance, then I must act as if he has provided it. I frequently ask God to help me to remember that he has a path for me. And so, when I talk about this group autonomy, I'm going to talk to you from my experience. I'm not going to start really getting carried away and talking to you in technical details about the 12th concept and, you know, and AA does not govern and they can't kick anybody out and all this type of stuff. And the fourth concept, of course, it says each group should be autonomous, which is kind of a self-directed self-government. But at the same token, our warranty says we have no real government. I say in AA, we do kind of have a governmental system, either at the group level or the area level, or the only thing is that we don't listen to it. it's as simple as that. You can make all the rules you want, and many AAs don't listen to them. But let me get back to what I was telling you about on my trip here, thinking about this. I got to tell you a story. My last drunk, I remember my last, I don't remember my last drink, I remember my last drunk. Because me and another fellow were arm in arm, shoulder over shoulder, with a mug of beer, in front of the jukebox in Kai's Bar, downtown Nagani, Michigan. And a big hit in 1975 was a song by Tom Jones, Delilah. And we were singing, because both of us were drinkers, and we had been divorced, and we had, you know, love and relationship problems, and so we were singing, why, Delilah. Now, that was about 11 o'clock on that night. Okay. The next thing that I remember, I don't remember my last drink, I don't know exactly what time it is. It was the police for knocking on my door in the Ghani. It was about 9 in the morning, and they said, Dave, you hit a couple of parked cars last night. And I said, oh, geez, I don't know, I feel all right, it's going to be me. And they said, well, your license plate fell off. We got the license plate. So they had me. Now, I had been 12-step prior to that. And my life was a series of things like that. I mean, I did my heavy drinking, but every now and then I got into a jam, and I temporarily straightened up. And so I called the guy who 12-stepped me, and he took me to my first AA meeting, the Ishpeming Hematite group, and I must have been ready or something about that group attracted me, because I haven't drank since I attended that AA meeting. And it's not to my credit, it's to the people that surrounded me and the group, et cetera, and the God as I understand him. But anyway, on this trip here, my wife and I stop. We leave Negaunee and we're in Menominee, Wisconsin, way up in the northwestern side of Wisconsin for lunch. And we're sitting there in a Perkins restaurant having lunch, and they got a PA system, and they're playing elevator-type music or oldies over it, and lo and behold, there's the song, Why, Why. And I says to my wife, this is going to be a good trip. It's got to be. You know. The next day, we're having lunch in Ardmore, Oklahoma, I think, is that? Right. Ooh, how do you say it? Ardmore? All right, now, you know, Ardmore, I was sober several years in the late 70s, and I went to a regional forum in Akron, Ohio. Now, this group of people that finally bought Dr. Bob's house and set it up, it was owned privately at the time, but it was a local guy from Ohio that took us on a little tour, a bunch of us. And we stopped in front of Dr. Bob's house on Ardmore. Yeah. It had our picture taken. It was privately a thing. So now, can you imagine Dr. Bob being a New Englander with his accent saying Ardmore? I just picture that. Ardmore. You know? I know, you know, people from Texas say it must be a four cylinder word. Right? Okay. Anyway, let me continue on my trip. Now I'm just my wife and I are I don't know how far it is, maybe 20 miles north of Austin. And we were advised by some people, when you get near Austin, and it was starting to rain. This is Thursday, coming into town. It was maybe 2 o'clock-ish. And there's this road you take, you know, when you bypass Austin, TS-130. You know, it's a toll road. So we took that road, and a beautiful road. You can go like 70 miles an hour. It's just every so often you got to stop and give them $1.50. But anyway, you know what? Last night you heard one of the speakers, and I've heard this many, many times in AA, where we're like cucumbers, and then we become a pickle, and you can never go back to being a cucumber when you're a pickle. You know what the name of that freeway is? It's the Pickle Parkway. Yeah, that's the name of the parkway that goes around Austin, Texas, the Pickle Parkway. So you see, I knew this was going to be a good trip. Delilah, Pickle Parkway. So here I am. Now, I think these traditions overlap a lot. You see, we got traditions on money and property and anonymity and public relations. And so if we talk about each group was autonomous, if we went and violated one of them traditions, which would affect AA perhaps as a whole, it's almost impossible to violate one tradition without violating more than one at the same time. Okay. And I don't like to use the word break tradition. Traditions are a spiritual concept like the steps are. And you don't break a spiritual concept. If you don't follow it, it breaks you. So, if we don't follow these traditions, they will break the group. Anyhow, I think group autonomy in many cases is kind of evolves. I sobered up in this Hematite group. The group was founded in 1954. I came in 1975. The founder of the group sobered up in 53. So he already had 22 years. He had a couple of old-timers that were with him that had 15 to 20 years. There was three of them, Gopher Joe and Bish. They sat up, if you looked at the front of the room where the head table was, they usually sat together kind of over on the left. We affectionately call this the Amen Corner. Now, these old-timers, they didn't come over as you walked in as a brand newcomer and pat you on the back and shake your hand. And I mean, there was a couple people that might have done that. But if you really wanted to get to know them, you had to go talk to them. If you really wanted to know what they thought about something, you had to ask. Okay? And that's kind of the attitude of the Ishbing-Hematite group. I have a dear friend. Her name is Fran, 33 years sobriety. And she came to the Ishbing-Hematite group years and years ago. And for a couple of years, she came into that meeting, said nothing, went into the back and the side and sat down. She didn't want to say anything. She didn't want anybody to talk to her. And it took her a couple of years. And finally now, she thanks the group for not pestering her. There are groups, you know, you walk, and I went to I was a delegate in 1986, by the way, and I was there when Pearson read that statement, but in fairness to us delegates, we were kind of nitpicky, but we lost the copyright to the big book, and Aretha Gresham, who was the managing editor of the Grapevine at the time, got fired, and she was from the East Central region, so we wanted some answers. You know, I don't know if they were nitpicky or not, but we didn't feel that AAWS was always giving us the answers. And we've had other conventions since then. You can talk to delegates in recent years that sometimes don't feel we're getting all the answers. Okay, so they have the right to question. You have the right to question when you go to your group. Moment of silence. 10 seconds. I counted.
Perfect.
10 seconds, he had a moment of silence. You ever go to a meeting and somebody says, let's have a moment of silence. And 3 seconds later, God grant. I didn't even got time to say the first words of the prayer out. Would you ever go to a meeting and somebody says, let's have a moment of silence, and they wait for 30 seconds. Now everybody's squirming in the chair. So how long is a moment of silence? Shouldn't that be debated at our groups? I mean, now that's nitpicky. That's nitpicky. Anyhow, I'm going to tell you a story about one of the old-timers, and it involves my drinking. I was sober 4 months, and I had a class reunion. I graduated in 1965, and the class reunion was in July, and I was 4 months sober, and I was a pretty popular high school kid, and I played football and basketball and the trombone and et cetera, and I had lots of friends, and I had an old girlfriend, you know. At the time I sobered up, and I want to let you know that, I was between, I had been divorced, and I went like 7 years before I come to AA, and I had 2 dates in 7 years. So when I sobered up, and I was only 27, you know, is there something in this called hormones or whatever it is? But anyway, they kind of come to life. And we were told very, very strictly by these old timers, hey, you got to wait a couple of years before you start monkeying around and having relationships. Okay? Well, I don't know if they still tell you that. But I have seen many, many people come into this program, have relationships, and they go to hell and they're drinking again. I've seen it happen. So there's reason behind this. It isn't just somebody made this up. Okay? But I did violate a little bit. My wife is sitting back there, and I was 1 year and 8 months sober when we got married. But we've been married now for 33 years. So, anyway, so. She's never seen me drink. Okay. Anyway, I went to this class reunion, and my first love, Linda, was going to be there. She's from California. She was, I always described her when I told my wife about her. She kind of looked like Jane Fonda, you know. But she went to California, and she became kind of hippie-ized and lived up, you know, didn't wear shoes anymore, and I think she smoked. Anyway, Linda was there. You're talking to a guy that didn't leave Nagani much, didn't leave the Hematite group much. So what I know about group activities is what I learned it by group. Anyway, this old-timer named Joe, I went to see Joe. I said, Joe, I'm kind of worried about my class reunion. 4 months sober, I want to go. And you know what Joe said? He said, Dave, he said, that's your class, 1965, right? Yeah, yeah. He said, you have a right to be there. It's your class. Enjoy yourself, he said, but you're going to reach a point after the dinner's over and whatever it is that you're going to become perhaps uncomfortable. Leave.
Simple. Thanks, Joe. So, I go to this class reunion, and my old high school girlfriend there is Linda, and I'm telling her about it. Hey, I joined. They want to know why I'm not drinking, of course. And then I'm telling her about AA, and you know, Linda tells me, she says, you know, Dave, you got to get out in Nagani. You've come homebound. You got to get out and see the world. And I'm looking at her, and I'm watching them beautiful red lips, and she's talking, you know. And she had me all, you know, I'm thinking, you know, maybe Linda's got a point here, you know. Well, you know, it wasn't much later. Linda slid off of her chair. Boom, under the table, and four guys picked her up and hauled her out to the car and put her in the car. And I said, I had a little bit of epiphany here. I said, I'm listening to this broad. You know, my spiritual experiences come in little pieces like that. Well, anyway, there was a fella there who had married a classmate of mine. He was a couple years older than her. And lo and behold, a lot of people noticed I was drinking Diet Coke or whatever it was, you know. Diet Coke, all right. Anyway, this fella, we started talking, and lo and behold, he was in the program. He had just sobered up, but he was down in Gwynn, a little town about 30 miles south. So I stayed the whole class reunion. His name was Sonny. Sonny and I sat at the end, chitty-chatting and everything, and stayed for the whole class reunion. Now, that isn't the end of the story. I come back, and Joe wanted to know, how did that thing go? And I told him, he said, Dave, you got to tell that story to the group. That's an important story. You got to tell it. You see, we talk our drunkologues all the time. I'm the star of my drunkologue. I'm the guy who was up at Michigan Tech and went to a football game with a bunch of guys and had a wineskin under my armpit because you weren't allowed to drink in the game, but we stuck tubes down there from chemistry lab and squeezed, and I didn't put wine in mine. I put brandy, Hartley's brandy. All right, and anyway, the game was over. I was all by myself. I'm the only one in the stadium. I passed out. I'm laying there. Okay, passed out, and I wake up. I go back to the dormitory. Well, you guys left me there. I said, we couldn't move you, Dave. Hell, you weighed 240 pounds. He said, we were going to come back and wake you up and get you, you know, with Dave. It was a nice day in October, and I'm sleeping in the stadium. Okay. Now, that story is humorous and funny when I tell it, but you know, there's a step beyond that story that we sometimes forget about our stories. I would later meet people. Maybe I'd be at a party or I'd be in a bar, and I'd meet some gal, and she'd say, oh, yeah, you're the guy that passed out in the stadium. See? I wasn't the guy that aced the physics test. I wasn't the big lover. I was the guy that passed out in the football stadium. And every one of our stories has got something like that. That's got to be shared, see, with the group. My recovery's like that, little bits and pieces. Now, I'm a snowbird now. I met a nice fellow over there that I'm going to get in touch to. He's an AA, and he's been living for 10 years in Sun City West. And there's Russ way back there. He's a member of the Monday Night Group in Sun City West, the big book group that I talked about. I have another home group. It's out in Arizona. My wife and I have been looking forward to someday becoming snowbirds, and we finally reached that point. 6 months, Arizona. So there's a group there. Now, you know what they do out there in Arizona? People read How It Works, and they get to that thing, and God could and would if he ever saw it. The whole group shouts it out. I nearly fell out of the chair the first time I heard it. Then they read them my promises, you know. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. And then they read the 12 traditions, and then they get down to that last line. Principles, you know, personality, or principles before personalities. And okay, we don't do that back at the Hematite group. I told them about it, and they said, you ain't doing that here. Right? We don't hold hands at my home group in Ishpeming, at the Hematite group. We say the Lord's Prayer, and we don't hold hands. A visitor comes in and they're reaching for your hand, and we don't hold hands. Get out of here. You know, we don't hold hands. See? Okay. Arizona, they're tripping over chairs. You got to knock tables down to hold hands, okay? Now, does that mean Arizona's bad AA? Ishpeming's bad AA? No, it doesn't. It means we got some things that we do that are different, but I have discovered that the basic fundamental bottom line of sobriety is there, whether I'm in hematite group or I'm in Arizona. It's a wonderful thing. Now, here's a couple other things I learned from my group autonomy. You see, this group autonomy evolved. We don't sit around and vote that I know of. Maybe they did, but in 35 years I've been a member of the Ishpeming Hematite Group, I don't ever remembering us saying, let's have a group conscious meeting and see if we're going to hold hands. No, we've had one and said, what's our prudent reserve? Okay, we've done that, and we decided on 6 months' rent, which is about $200. So we keep $200 back for rent. That's our prudent reserve at the Ishpeming Hematite Group. Yeah. So we can argue that. Is that too much? Is that too little? We keep 6 months' rent. How much are we going to give to GSO? How much are we going to give to our area? How much are we going to give to the district? Well, we got to find out how much we got, and we do this about every 6 months. And there might be some other issue that comes along that we take an actual group conscience. But some of these things just evolve. I don't know if the old timers passed them on, like I was telling you about. So one of the things that I like is I think every member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's been sober for a while, has gone through the steps, who has caught fire, is in this, transformed into the fourth dimension or whatever it is, like, you got to be. If you're going to spend the money to come here, you guys got to be in the fourth dimension, okay? So, anyway, we should be able to, at any point and any time, if somebody says, Dave, how do you work the fourth step? I should be, it is my responsibility, I should be instantaneously able to tell a newcomer in a few minutes how I worked a step. You know, without having to go off on a big thing, start digging out a whole bunch of books and flipping through this and flipping through that. I should be able to tell them that. That's my job. That's my responsibility. Okay. I can look at my card here, John, see where I am. If you're in doubt about something in your group, if something like 10-second moment of silence bothers you, I would suggest that perhaps, first of all, you ask a member who's been there for a while. They might be able to save you some embarrassment by telling you why they do something the way they do. But if it really bothers you, there's nothing wrong with you bringing something up at the group level and asking about it. The tradition says every group should be autonomous. Not maybe, can be, will be, it says should be autonomous. That means we should be self-directing, that we should be able to make decisions. Not a couple of people that make decisions for that whole damn group. Not a couple of people. Okay. So, you got a question, you're new, where does our money go? How much do we give to GSO? GSR, I haven't heard the GSR, you know, GSR report. Et cetera, et cetera. Those questions should be asked. Okay. Other than that, my advice is if you're these little things like holding hands and that bother you, I say this. When you're in Arizona, you do what the Arizonians do, and when you're in Michigan, you do what the Michiganders do. It's as simple as that. You'll get along just fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Dave, that was great. Before I introduce our last speaker, last night I heard something that was really good. You're in Bexar County. It's spelled B-E-X-A-R. Don't ask why. It's Bexar County. In Bexar County in San Antonio, and there's about 2.2 million people that live here. It's the seventh largest city in the United States. we calculate that we're one of the worst alcoholic counties in the world because we have a lot of booze here and people drink a lot. So that means that probably 10%, at least 10% of the population is alcoholic. So that means there's about 200,000 plus drunks running around the street out there right now as we're speaking, talking about group autonomy. And there was 51 or 2,000 people in the Alamo Dome last night, we think. We don't know for sure. And there's another 4 or 5,000 people in AA in Bexar County at any given time, based on all the number of groups with a multiplier, we would figure maybe. So that meant that somewhere around this area last night, there was about 57,000 drunks. Now go back to the Alamo and those guys that were inside. We're like the guys inside the Alamo, and there's still a lot of them out there that are coming after our ass. So our work's cut out for us, believe me. And I'm going to introduce our next speaker. Diane is from Missouri, and she's going to talk about group autonomy. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Diane. I'm an alcoholic. I'm excited to be here. This is my third international convention, and I just want to share that at my first international convention, the topics were very interesting to me, and I really was interested in this one meeting on sex, security, and society. I was like, right on. And I went to that meeting and found out I was on the fourth step. So when I was given the group autonomy, I'm like, all right, where's that at in the books? And as the other speakers have pointed out, it's the fourth tradition. And regarding the fourth tradition, I love group autonomy. I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous since the 24th day of November in 1988. And by far, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life. I'd like to, with your permission, share a little bit of my story. Okay. Restless, irritable, discontent, self-pity oozing from every pore. This is me from childhood. In my early teens, I had a little bit of a taste of alcohol, but it really didn't do much for me. A couple of years later, I still have all these defects of character and all this restlessness. But I started sort of backwards. I started doing the geographical cures. My first geographical cure was that I got married when I was very young. And my second one is that I moved to Southern Ireland. And while we were in Southern Ireland, missionaries, no less, God has always been important to me. Our spirituality, it's confusing to me now, religion and spirituality still, but we were going to convert the Catholics. Okay, so I've always been a zealot, I guess. I was however many months pregnant. We were there for 5 or 6 weeks. Our son, Timothy, came early. He lived for a day, and then he died. And when I came home from the hospital, I started drinking. I had, even though I came from a religious background and I had some training and I was, in fact, a foreign missionary, I didn't have any tools in place to deal with that sort of a situation. And for the next 4.5 years, I drank. And it was like I was living in the middle of a cyclone. And no matter whatever I had close or precious to me, my children, my marriage, my friends, were just ripped. Alcoholism ripped it from my hands, and it was gone, and I was left alone. When I hit bottom, I was seven and a half months pregnant with another man's child and still married to my first husband. This is incomprehensible, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I have that T-shirt. I wanted to die. By the grace of God, I had the presence of mind to focus on my then-husband, needed help. And we got into some counseling, and I came in the back door through the program of, through the Al-Anon program, and was there for not very long, and I realized I was so uncomfortable. And asked for an evaluation, and I was in the early stages of alcoholism. In terms of chemistry, I just want to make that very clear. I've had a blackout, DWI, a lot of things that hadn't happened to me yet. But emotionally, I was at a very dark bottom. So I went ahead and married that raging, abusive, active alcoholic, like a good Al-Anon. And, or not really, it wasn't an Al-Anon thing, it was a codependent thing. Anyway, so, and I didn't go to a lot of meetings. I was so afraid. I was still really holding on to my own self-sufficiency. And maybe there was some merit to not leaving little children home with a raging alcoholic. Anyway, I'm one of the slowlies. They say the promises come quickly and sometimes slowly. I was a slowly, really afraid to surrender. At about 6 years of not drinking, things started to change for me. I did start doing things like working the steps and asking God to remove some of my defects of character. One of mine, as soon as I stopped drinking, then I was the rage. Then I could also rage with him. And it, those things happened, and I was very grateful for that. And then the funniest thing, I started praying for courage. I didn't know what to pray for. I knew things had to change, so I started praying for courage and the courage to change. And after 6 years, I got the courage to say, I've had enough. I can't do this anymore. I knew with some clarity that I would drink again if I stayed in this marriage. And he said, you know, you always say that. And he was right. I always said that. But this one time, I meant it. And we did divorce. And then the only person I had to look at was me. So fortunately, by some other circumstances that really aren't important, I found out about some meetings in a town. I lived about an hour southwest of St. Louis at the time. I found out about a meeting that started at 7 in the morning, and I could get there, I'd go to the meeting, grab a bite to eat, and then go to work. I was self-employed at the time. And I did that. If my truck left my driveway at 6 a.m., I could be in the meeting on time. I started doing that, and that meeting, they did things different. My first home group, you know, we did the preamble, we read how it works, and then it was topics. These meetings I was going to now, they were reading literature, and they were talking more about steps, and the traditions were hanging on the wall, and it was just, there seemed to be more structure, and I started to grow. A few years later, you know, everyone's growing up in my household, not just me. I have four sons, and when I had about, 10 years in the program, was when my sons started to go into treatment or started using, and things changed again, and we ended up with my moving in from the country into the city because it was going to be better when my son got home from treatment for us to be away from all of his using friends. And oh my gosh, how cool was it? I loved it that I could go to a meeting any time. I didn't have to like be, you know, concerned about leaving the house at 6 in the morning for, I could say, I'll be back, you know, in 90 minutes. I'm going to go down and go to a meeting. And that was not an issue. And, you know, the meetings almost always started with the preamble and the how it works. And there was a real heartbeat to it. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I have to share this part of my story because this is really what has catapulted me to where I'm at now. And that is to say that raising teen sons was not a cakewalk in terms of they were using. And I had to set boundaries with them and get some of them to treatment. And we spent a lot of time in family therapy with the substance abuse counselor. And, you know, fortunately, those things were available to us. when I hit about 17 years, I didn't want to go to meetings anymore. I was tired. Living with active alcoholics, you know, my son, some of them had gone to live with their dad because I wouldn't allow them to use it at my house, and not that their father would, but it was maybe easier or whatever the situation was. I didn't want to go to meetings. And so, but I knew, because my first sponsor said to me, if you drink again, you will die. She scared the shit out of me. Pardon me, but she scared me when she'd say that, because I didn't really hit a low chemical bottom, but I believed her. And do you know, when she was 10 years sober, she did go back out, and she did die. And so I knew that. And so I really believed that if I quit going to meetings, I was going to use again, then I didn't know what was going to happen. And so I made myself the coffee person at a really big meeting. And I mean, I have to make 6 or 8 pots of coffee during the meeting. This is a big meeting. And it's just, you have to get there early and everything. And then I made myself the coffee person at the same time with my home group. And so for twice a week, I got to be there. And then, you know, just by chance, just by God's chance, someone who was working for me talked to me about a district meeting. And I said, I don't know anything about a district meeting. What are you talking about? And I went with him to the district meeting. And after a couple of months, they had some elections. And at the elections, I stood for and was voted as the alternate DCM. Well, I went to my home group and I told them that I was the alternate DCM. And one of my home group members, who's like a brother to me, Mark, said, what does that mean? I said, I don't know. What does it stand for? I don't know. Well, because I was self-employed, I had such a great time, so I got to go visit all the meetings. And in District 41, in Area 38, we have, whether it's a group or a meeting, 50 or so times a week alcoholics meet. And I think just every single one of those starts out with the preamble and how it works and, you know, are there any birthdays or any visitors. It's, you know, pretty much the same. But after that, it all changes. Some of them are all men's. Some of them you can smoke. Some of them are all women's. Some of them are mixed groups. Other ones, they do the big book. Some of them, they, depending on what week you get there, they do the big book, the 12 and 12, they got a speaker, whatever. They have different formats. Some of them celebrate birthdays. Some of them announce at the district meeting what nights they're going to have cake. And others, you know, like, and I was the recipient a couple of weeks ago, they give scholarships to different events around town. It's a very diverse and really, it's a beautiful district. And I'm honored to be a part of it. And I'm now the DCM of that district. And that's so different being the DCM, because the way I was suggested to me, and for me, suggestions in Alcoholics Anonymous are like suggestions in skydiving. When you jump out of the plane, pull the cord. Okay, it was suggested to me that, I don't share my opinion as a DCM, but I just foster conversation and try to direct the GSRs to make their decisions so the district would have its own conscience. And so we decided that some of them really want to go talk to these groups about money. We need more money. We need more money. You know, in the end, we decided that what we need to do is educate the groups. This is a service structure. A lot of people don't know about it. I didn't know about it myself until I was around for about 17 years. And let the other things, let it all follow. Let it just happen the way it's supposed to happen. There you go. So that's what we've done. It's been very nice, and it's been more elegant than going and telling people how much money we don't have or how much money we need. Some of the things that have come up in the groups that are, it's been charming, honestly, is apart from the money thing is, some of the groups are taking inventory, which is delightful to see. And then some of the groups had struggled with and would come to the district meeting and talk about, we're having issues, and one of them in particular was singleness of purpose. And so they really took some time and had a couple of group consciences over time. It was very nice to hear how they worked that out and how we didn't have to have an opinion, but to support this GSR. And but the most recently, we had one come in really not knowing what to do and asking about a hot dog meeting. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I didn't say that. But he said that someone was contributing the money and that he didn't know about that and what did the district think about it. And I was so grateful that I didn't have to have an opinion. And we were, and the GSRs and the committee members are very loving, I thought, and did share with him, you know, that that was really the group's conscience, whatever you all decide is what you decide. But I don't know if that's been what you came here looking for. But that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, that this is a spiritual program, and we all do have our own separate fingerprints, and so do our groups, and that's how it works. That's all I've got. Thanks.